Well, what a wonderful confluence of hymns and songs and themes and anthems for a day that I'm preaching about preaching. This is kind of the postmodern meta world that I live in. Breathing in, breathing out. The title for this sermon, The Preacher's Vanity, comes from Ecclesiastes, which is normally, if badly translated, as vanity of vanities saith the preacher, all is vanity. Well, it's a terrible translation. That's not what it says in the Hebrew. What it says in the Hebrew is havel havalim, havel havalim, amar koheleth, hakol havel. And that is breath of breath. Breath is the central experience. It isn't about vanity, as in, I feel pretty vanity. It isn't about vanity as it doesn't mean anything. It is about breathing, hence the word inspiration, hence the sense that somebody expires. Breathing is a central spiritual discipline and a lifelong habit. That's really what it's about. But I'm using for today's sermon the bad translation of vanity of vanity, saith the preacher, to talk about the preacher's vanity. What it takes to be a preacher, to give a sermon, to drive up to a building and see a parking lot filled and people in the pews and be expected to have something sensible to say. And the expectations are often way too high on the part of a congregation. Preachers are human beings. And it isn't, in fact, the preacher's job to know everything. Preaching has, I think, an interesting history to it. But this sermon comes out of the sense of, well, preachers have two fears, and this is of all religions, by the way. This is not Christian, Jewish, Muslim, of any denominations. Preachers have two fears. One is that nobody's listening. It's the Father McKenzie writes the sermon that no one will hear, no one draws near. No one shows up, and if they show up, they're not listening. And if they show up, they're not listening because they're here to see their friends, and they really don't care, and they're really not paying attention. They're looking at their watches, they're shaking their watches, they're falling asleep, and why am I sitting here and working on this? That is one part of a preacher's paranoia. The other great fear that preachers have is that you're listening. And that every mistake is going to be found. And any error of judgment, any lapse of history, any, in some denominations, any doctrinal missteps will be heard and will count against you, and there will be a severe interest penalty of early withdrawal of the congregation from the sanctuary. And I have to admit to that one. That one's daunting. It's daunting to come up here week after week and talk to people who, and this is just, this is not playing violins or ladling it on, who are bright and educated and interested in the world, and most importantly, are not going to take what I say as gospel. That's one great fear that I don't have. I don't have a great sense of responsibility that if I make a mistake, you'll walk over the cliff. Because they're Unitarian Universalists tend not to be like lemmings. They're much more interested in discussing the reality of the cliff and if it's really true about lemmings than they are about marching over that cliff. That's why there are no Unitarian Jonestowns. I mean, if I told you to sell everything and we'd go hide out in the mountains, I could be really lonely for a really long period of time. If I told you how to be, how to do, what to do, I don't expect that many people would take a fundamentalist approach. You'd say, interesting, you might consider what I have to say, but you are going to think and judge for yourselves, and that is actually what you should do. We should take all of us, each other, seriously and respectfully, but not assume that anyone, by dint of education or title or even experience, knows everything. I remember opening up my sermon drawer many years ago and finding about 15,000 pages of manuscript. I came to two conclusions from that. One, that I wish that I'd been being paid by the word, and the other was that I don't know that much. So I don't have, at that time, 15,000, by now probably 35,000 pages of answers. I have 35 pages of questions, of wonder, of poem, of song, of things that are sometimes smart, sometimes pithy, some that work, some that don't work. One of my mentors said, John, if your preaching is consistent, you're consistently mediocre. You can only do well if you stretch. And stretching means occasionally snapping and falling and crashing, and that's okay with me. This is a safe place for me to take risks and for me, frankly, to bomb from time to time. It's okay, because I want to model that it's also a safe place for all of us to take chances and to stretch. And everything does not have to come out perfectly, but we have to come from places of truth and authenticity. What brought the topic to mind originally was the, I think, wrong-headed preaching of Reverend Wright and his condemnation of America in terms that were, for me, over the top. The complaints that a black preacher would have are very understandable. The metaphors and the exact charges of promoting HIV and the intentionality of evil and cruelty as opposed to the evil of indifference is where I believe that he went off the mark and in a way that he could not be heard. But this sermon is not about him, and it's not about Obama, and it's not about the politics. It's about the preaching. The question, and it's a legitimate question that should come up in UU and U orientation, is, are you judged by the church that you go to? Or the temple, or the mosque, or the ashram? Can people make legitimate inferences about your morals, your ethics, and your politics from the fact that you go to a Unitarian Universalist church? There are probably some things that they could guess at but not know. Can they make legitimate inferences because of my preaching about who you are? Well, some, in terms of your ability to tolerate my particular sense of humor and my vocabulary and my interests, but can they make assumptions about you and your politics and your ethics for my sermons? I don't know. I don't think so. Can they for my columns? Maybe more so. Although lots of people read my columns just to get annoyed, and it doesn't necessarily say anything about their politics. What they write me says a lot about their politics, but the fact that they read me doesn't say anything about their politics. That the church that you go to, the temple, mosque, ashram that you go to, doesn't really connect you automatically to the preaching from that pulpit or from that floor. Most religious organizations are liturgical, and that is, people come for the liturgy. They come for the comfort of a liturgy, of the ritual of things being together and the same week after week, that it creates an experience of some order in the chaos of our world. Some people come to see their friends. I think that's a great idea. You ought to come and see your friends. Some people that come to show off their clothes that I mentioned last week, and that applies to Dick Cole and to me, and I don't know what the rest of you are doing here if that's what you were thinking about. But those are all valid reasons to come to church. Just to be together, to celebrate together, to struggle, to share joys, to share sorrows. Preaching in some ways is the least of it. It may be a glue, it may be the thing that attracts the group in the first place. But sermons have an interesting history, or at least I think they have an interesting history. My sermons certainly have referring back to Reverend Wright and those terrible loops that they played, and if Obama is the candidate, that they'll play all September, October, and November, those loops. And I'm thinking back, in my 38 years, have I said anything that I've regretted? Oh, yeah. Can I name my stupidest sermon? Oh, absolutely. I will tell you, the dumbest sermon I ever gave was at Studio City, and it was about hunger in the third world, and it examined the question of, should we send surplus food and wheat to starving areas? Because isn't that really just going to let them live longer in order to reproduce more, in order to bring more starvation into the world? Are we bringing life or are we bringing death? And Ethel Helenthal, who was sitting actually where you're sitting, in the analogous spot, said, but I don't understand, John. If we got food today and people are starving today, why wouldn't we give them food? And I said, I picked up my sermon manuscript and I said, you just heard 8 pages of nonsense and 1 good question of wisdom, with the question implied the answer. That was a sermon that I would want back, except for, as catastrophic a moral and intellectual failure as it was one of the most valuable sermons I ever gave, because it taught humility and taught that you can take a chance and be wrong, and Ethel forgave me and the congregation forgave me for having really come up with a stupid intellectual, in the head, not in the heart, sermon. And that was good learning. The next dumbest thing, I think, was probably the one that was here, and that was when I absolutely promised the congregation dinner that Joe Lieberman would not be nominated for vice president on the Democratic ticket. I think I can make the same promise for the Republican ticket with almost the same certainty. I was, of course, wrong, and I paid off with lunch, okay? And what that was doing in a sermon, I'm not sure, but it was there, and I did pay it off. And then, just so that all 3 of the churches that I've served get mentioned, in my first church up in Northern California, Star King Hayward, I was giving a very know-it-all, sophomoric, those are synonyms, talk on sex and sexuality. And during the talk back, a very old guy got up, kind of staggered to his feet. I think he was probably in his mid-40s. Hey, I was 25. He was a really old guy. And he said, you know, I remember this in a codger voice, you know, when I was younger, in terms of sex, I thought about quantity, but now that I'm more mature, I think about quality. And I immediately said, yes, necessity is the mother of invention. And it was a funny line, and it wasn't over the top in terms of not being fit for consumption in a church, particularly not a Northern California church in the 60s, but it was a laugh at his expense. And that was wrong. We, in the loop of years, pouring out words and images and insights and jokes, sometimes drive over a cliff. And we hope that we create relationships that are strong enough to forgive us our moral and rhetorical trespasses. Sermons are kind of funny. The first sermon, as far as I'm able to discern, was given by Ezra the scribe. Strangely enough, not in the book of Ezra, but in Nehemiah, where he sets up a wooden pulpit in front of the water gate. Now here I'm going to take just the guess that they wasn't referring to the one in Washington, but the one in Jerusalem, and he explains the law. That's the first sermon, and from that you can infer, I think legitimately, that the law is complex and confusing, and that it needs explanation, it needs interpreters, because there's more than one way of understanding it. what is significant and a little humbling for the preacher is that this first recorded sermon wasn't recorded. And we have no idea what Ezra said or what Ezra explained. The next most important sermon is certainly the Sermon on the Mount. And then we have some of the great American sermons. Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. It's a wonderful sermon. It's not in the key of Unitarian, because it's all about sin, and you have no right to be here, and only the hand of God is staying the floodgates of hell. But it's a fun sermon to do. And I can understand how preachers really have a good time with that, because it's just filled with that energy. So when I was watching Wright preaching, I felt that energy. And that energy is a real temptation when you get into that loop with what becomes somewhere between a congregation and an audience. Probably the second greatest American sermon is Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. That really is a sermon. It really is an invocation to peace and to forgiveness and to honor the sacrifices that mostly men on both sides made in order to create a more perfect union and end the great breach in the union. Sermons are important in what they say, not in that you follow them religiously, but that we give each other open minds and open hearts. When I think of the sermons that have touched my life, the greatest one is certainly that of Martin Luther King and the I Have a Dream. It's certainly hearing that again and again every year and often several times during the course of the year, talking about that dream, because that dream touched me and changed me. Do I remember every word of it? No. I can do the Gettysburg Address. I can't do the I Have a Dream because I get choked up halfway through. It has the ability to move me to tears for how it moved my heart, for how it moved my hands, for how it moved my feet. Because he brought a dream and he brought hope that we could further heal the great divide in this nation, the divide on race, and when he was killed, he was working on the divide of class, and of war, and of peace. I was living in North Africa when he was assassinated, and we had an assembly at school where I was teaching. And think about this for a moment in this modern world where we feel so separate from Arabs and Muslims. Here was a memorial service for a black Christian preacher conducted in an Arab-Muslim country in an Arab-Muslim school. The I Have a Dream speech was given in French by my colleague, Monsieur Atia, and I wept. And I wept, and the children wept. They didn't understand exactly who he was, but they knew something terrible had happened to America, and by my tears, they knew that it was something important that touched my heart. And there were 3,500 Muslim kids who were absolutely still in listening to this I Have a Dream speech in French. I tried to explain, and there is no explanation, why he was dead, what the source of hate was, what it meant to have an idea of civil disobedience, what it meant to be respectful of people and yet willing to break the law in a way that subjected oneself to the law. There was a hard, civil disobedience is a very hard concept to explain in an authoritarian regime, because you follow the laws or you break the laws, and those are the two ways that things happen. Or you break the laws when nobody's watching. But the idea of breaking man's law, and I'm using that accurately in this case, of breaking man's law because of a sense of a higher law, of a human right that surpasses mere legislation, is a very difficult concept. And then to add to it and you have to do it in broad daylight when people are watching. Civil disobedience is not done sneaky. That's terrorism or pranksterism if it's not too violent. Civil disobedience is while the world watches, you subject yourself to that. And it makes a difference. That sermon changed my life. It took me into the Peace Corps. It took me into North Africa. It took me into the clergy because I didn't want to spend my life doing what my academic background had prepared me to do in international relations, politics, economics, and military strategy. I thought that there was something better to do, which was to look for those things that nourish the human spirit, the human soul, and the human body. And I thought that religion and Unitarian Universalism was one way of doing that. And the inspiration from Martin Luther King's preaching should give all preachers some sense of humility because it was so good. But what made it good was its authenticity and passion. A preacher doesn't have to be right. A preacher does have to be true. And what we get from a sermon is usually not a long and reasoned argument. Great sermons are shorter than this one because you take away one or two, the most three images or metaphors that you then turn over and polish and make your own. And the one from this sermon, because it's the one that I truly believe and it is the grandchild intellectually of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speeches, he said, I have been to the mountaintop, and I might not get there with you, but he believed in it. And I want to tell you that from the mountaintop, he could see what the promised land looked like. He could see that there would be a day where children, black and white, and Asian and Hispanic, could join hands and walk together in peace. He could see it from the mountaintop. 40 years later, we can still see that promised land. And the good news is, we don't have to be on the mountaintop. We can see it from level ground. It is closer. It is within reach. It is within reach of our children. If we continue to take those sermons and those dreams, and sermons become poems, that become songs, that become dances, that become footsteps that advance us along the road. We can see that promised land. Step by step, we will advance the cause, and our children and grandchildren will live there. May it be so.